Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Tuesday, October 3rd, 2023. Authorities in South Sudan investigate the killing of a US-British journalist.
And should not only be for Christopher Allen. Remember, we have Peter Moy, who was killed in 2014. We also have Isaiah Abram, who was killed in 2012. And our five members that were killed in unknown circumstances in Raja. And one of our colleagues in this site of Kobo.
And UN says 300,000 people in South Sudan will face hunger this year.
We're talking of robbery, sexual violence, and long journeys on foot with no food or water. By the time they arrive in South Sudan, the resources have been depleted and they're already well on their way to a hunger emergency.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan government has started an investigation into the killing of Christopher Allen, a US-British journalist who was killed in South Sudan in 2017. The Union of Journalists of South Sudan welcomes the decision, adding it could enhance justice for several other local journalists killed in the line of duty in South Sudan. For VOA News, Wake, Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
South Sudan's Minister for Cabinet Affairs, Martin Elia Lomro, issued an order Monday establishing a six-member committee to investigate Christopher Allen's death, a U.S.-British journalist killed in South Sudan in 2017. The committee is expected to submit its findings within 2 weeks. Majaka Daniel Kwani, the Secretary General of the Union of Journalists of South Sudan, welcomes the decision to investigate Allen's death, adding that it was long overdue. Kwani urges the committee to publish its findings.
Whatever information that they will be able to provide to the public later, any independent committee will be able now to use it as a basis to start the investigation.
Freelance journalist Christopher Allen, who had a dual American-British citizenship, was killed when fighting erupted between former rebels of the SPLA-IO and government forces in Kaya, Central Equatorial State, along the border between South Sudan and Uganda in 2017. In 2019, his parents publicly demanded that the country's government deliver justice for the death of their son. South Sudan National Army and the SPLA-IO loyal to the country's first vice president, Riek Machar, accused one another of being responsible for killing Allen, who at the time of his death embedded with the former rebels of the SPLA-IO. Colonel Lampaul Gabriel, the SPLA-IO spokesperson, welcomes the launch of the investigation into Allen's killing, but expressed reservations about the composition of the committee.
This is going to be a little bit really biased, and I just hope that I thought they were going to make like the call would be for unity government. That means we should be having the committee, a balanced committee, not necessarily co-opting them later on, but taking it very serious and also maybe giving it to the joint defense board if they're very serious about it, because at the moment it is only the joint defense board that has got a command and control he has got like a serious command and control over all these forces, both the opposition and the SSPD forces. But when you look at this committee, it's completely one-sided. So I believe that I still doubt the report will really come out genuinely and transparently.
Kwani says investigating Allen's killing gives hope that the government is ready to look into other mysterious killing of local journalists.
It should be a very good call to see our government that is addressing issues of impunity regarding crimes that are committed against journalists, and should not only be for Christopher Allen. Remember, we have Peter Moy, who was killed in 2014. We also have Isaiah Abram, who was killed in 2012, and our five members that were killed in a known circumstance in Raja, and one of our colleagues in this site of Akobo.
VOA contacted the public affairs officer at the U.S. Embassy in Juba for comments on the story, but did not get a response. U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan Michael Adler has continued to call on the government of South Sudan to investigate the killers of Christopher Allen. In August 2017, the South Sudan government handed Allen's body to a representative of the U.S. Embassy in Juba. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
The World Food Program warns a hunger emergency is looming in South Sudan as aid agencies run out of the resources needed to care for tens of thousands of people who have crossed the border from the conflict-ridden Sudan. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Nearly 300,000 people have fled to South Sudan since conflict erupted in Sudan in April. The World Food Program reports more than 1,000 people continue to arrive every day. It says most of the new arrivals are returnees, South Sudanese who had been living in Sudan as refugees for many years. Speaking from Juba today, WFP Country Director in South Sudan, Mary Ellen McRorty, says people crossing the border tell harrowing tales of escape as they made their way to South Sudan.
We're talking of robbery, sexual violence, and long journeys on foot with no food or water. By the time they arrive in South Sudan, the resources have been depleted and they're already well on their way to a hunger emergency. The families that we see crossing today are much, much more vulnerable and food insecure than those that arrived in the early weeks of the conflict, and it's getting worse.
McRorty says 90% of families have gone multiple days without eating. She says recent WFP data also show that 1 in 5 children and more than a quarter of mothers screened at the border are malnourished. She says the situation is further exacerbated by ongoing rain and flooding that has wiped out roads in Renk, the main border crossing from Sudan. She says the mud and stagnant water in makeshift camps for people in transit are the perfect breeding ground for disease. She says WFP is supporting the newly arrived families with hot meals, high-energy biscuits, dry rations, and cash transfers. But she notes WFP barely has the money to feed these families today, let alone to help them build a sustainable future.
Many of the communities people are returning to are also facing humanitarian crises of their own, driven by conflict, climate crisis, and soaring food prices. So far, we have registered over 220,000 returnees arriving some of the most food insecure zones of the country. These returnees are fleeing danger, the danger of war, to a situation of absolute despair.
McRorty says WFP has received less than half of the $526 million it needs to run its humanitarian operation for the next 6 months. Because of the severe funding shortage, she says WFP has been forced to slash food rations by half for people who already are chronically hungry. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Some families who fled fresh fighting between the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces in Nyala town of South Darfur State say hundreds of women and children are still stranded in some, and some are caught up in a crossfire in Nyala town. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Juba.
A member of the Darfur Women Forum says hundreds of women and children are stranded in Nyala town amidst the ongoing fighting. Eyewitnesses who fled renewed fighting in Nyala town of South Darfur State last week say the violence has displaced more civilians who are now seeking refuge in North and East Darfur states. Sarah Mustafa, a mother of five, describes the situation in Nyala as horrific and calls on the warring parties to stop targeting civilians. She says she managed to escape the fighting in Nyala a week ago and has now settled in Rabak town of White Nile State. Mustafa told VOA via a messaging application that she spent 2 days traveling from Nyala to Rabak town.
Along the road, there are many checkpoints set up by armed groups. They threaten civilians and take some of their valuable belongings. That's why there is no way for humanitarian aid organizations to reach the needy in Niala with medicines or food commodities.
Another Niala town resident, Najat Dafalla, says she managed to escape violence last week and now settled in El Jain of East Darfur State. Dafalla describes the situation as horrible, adding that hundreds of civilians, including women and children, are still stranded inside the town with no food or medicines.
Most of civilians are now internally displaced persons or refugees, and those who are stranded in the town are still there because some of them do not have means to escape due to tense security situation besides the hard economic conditions.
Fatima Abdulrahim fled fighting in Niala town and arrived at El Jain of East Darfur State over the weekend. She says a rocket hit her house in a Safa neighborhood in Niala last week, forcing her to leave the town with her three kids. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says that about 5.4 million people have fled their homes and sought refuge within Sudan or neighboring countries since the fighting started in mid-April. The report says an estimated 188,000 refugees have abandoned hotspot area to other locations across Sudan. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
The United Nations Security Council has approved a resolution to authorize a multinational force to Haiti, led by Kenya, to help combat violent gangs that have overwhelmed police. Haiti's requested an intervention force a year ago, but neither the United Nations nor the UN were willing to lead one. Kenya stepped up in July with an offer to lead a multinational force. Today in Nairobi, Kenyan President William Ruto said his government is ready to take on the mission.
I welcome the resolution as an overdue and critical instrument to define the multinational mission. This mission is a fundamental intervention to provide the necessary conditions for Haiti to consolidate its development and governance. It is therefore absolutely essential that resources, as well as operational scope available to the UN team, as well as other humanitarian and development actors on the ground in Haiti, be appropriately reinforced.
While some Kenyans say their country's leading role in the Haiti mission is a good idea, others are expressing concerns about the proposal. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo has this story.
Kenyans are divided on the issue of sending 1,000 members of its police force to help quell gang violence in Haiti.
There are countries much stronger than us who could have intervened first. Those criminal elements in Haiti, first of all, I think they don't need police. They need soldiers.
I think that the Kenyan police force is a force that we have. We have faith in it, and there's no reason why we should doubt their capacity.
The Kenyan government says Haiti's far-off location in the Caribbean isn't a deterrent.
We decided we are going to go and help Haiti.
Cabinet Secretary for Foreign and Diaspora Affairs Alfred Mutua recently announced Kenya is ready to lead the multinational police force.
We've got other African nations that are coming on board. We've got other nations from all the world. They're saying if Kenya is leading it, we think there's going to be success. So they're coming on board.
On a recent visit to Kenya, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin lauded the plan.
And we intend to work with the United States Congress to provide up to $100 million in support. And we urge others in the international community to follow Kenya's great example.
Austin was in Nairobi with his Kenyan counterpart, Adan Dwale.
Kenya has a very long history of global peacekeeping. We were in Kosovo, we were in Namibia, we were everywhere. We are now in Somalia, we are in DRC. We have our officers in the Tigray monitoring and evaluation mechanism.
But others, like former Kenyan Defense Secretary Eugene Wamalwa, disagree.
First of all, I mean, what interest would we have to be in Haiti as a third world country that is over 12,000 kilometers away, that many of our officers don't even understand, I mean, don't even know French or Creole in terms of even communicating with the Haitians? It would be a problem. And even in terms of training and preparation to engage in such a complex security situation, where there's urban warfare with the gangs.
Vincent Kimosop is a Kenyan economist and policy analyst.
It's unprecedented. We only get to hear about Haiti if it is not natural disasters, the issues of insecurity, political instability. But you know, the people who are in Haiti have an African descent. And we have an Ubuntu philosophy in Africa. I am because you are, and because you are, I am. Yeah. So when you remove the political, eventually a decision to go help a neighbor who is struggling will be loaded within a broader conversation in the African context.
Kimosop says he supports the administration's decision, but also believes the government should be more transparent and communicate more with the Kenyan public. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, some members of the U.S. Congress oppose sending aid to Ukraine. Find out why after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. The Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi confirmed Monday that he will run for a third term in December's election. Sisi told the Egyptian people that if they want to replace him, the ballot is their way. The campaign of Ahmed al-Tantawi and the most prominent opponent to Sisi has complained that citizens have been hindered when they tried to support his candidacy. Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the Egypt-Japan University in Alexandria, discusses the elections with VOA's senior analyst Muhammad Al-Ashanawi.
Politics in the Middle East are usually behind a strong one-man show who stays in power for a long time, whether this is a monarchy or a republic. There was no surprise in this announcement, taking into consideration this long political tradition in the area, including Egypt. So nobody had been shocked, nobody was surprised. And so this is a continuation of a tradition and a political culture in the area, with that idea that the incumbent president stays on for a long time and he can only be removed either through divine intervention, revolution, military coup, assassination, but not through the ballot box. So no surprise here.
Well, President Sisi told the Egyptian people if they wanted to replace him, the ballot box is the way. The campaign of Ahmed al-Tantawi, a former member of the parliament and the most prominent potential opponent to Sisi, has complained that citizens have been impeded when they try to register their support for his candidacy. Egyptian National Election Authority has called such allegations baseless. How do you explain this discrepancy?
Historically, since the establishment of the Egyptian Republic in 1953, the political culture and the state remained biased toward backing any incumbent head of state, and they are not positive or responsive to any rival candidate. There is no surprise here unless the state becomes neutral toward all candidates and absorbs the idea that an incumbent head of state or president can lose through free and fair elections. So far, this cultural change has not happened. And that's why you are seeing they say one thing, but on the ground, something else takes place.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi warned that his country could face weeks of unrest from 100,000 people in difficult economic circumstances, and said, imagine if I give each one £1,000, a pack of narcotics and tramadol, they can cause turmoil with a cost of only $30 million. What was the purpose of this strange warning, and how was it received among Egyptians?
As you know, improvising and not reading a written speech is very much characteristic of speeches made by President Sisi. And this always causes a lot of confusion, misunderstanding, and speculations.
That was Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the Egypt-Japan University. He was speaking with my colleague, Mohammed Alashanawi. The White House is determined to continue supporting Ukraine. President Joe Biden says, despite what appears to be cracks in Congress and the NATO alliance, with Slovakia newly elected leader expressing doubts over continuing his nation's support. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
Cracks are appearing in the wall of Western support for Ukraine as President Joe Biden beseeches congressional Republicans to grant the $24 billion he seeks to fortify Ukraine against Russia's invasion. Congress over the weekend passed a stopgap spending bill that keeps the U.S. government open for another 6 weeks. But that package did not include the Ukraine aid, leading Biden to appeal across the political aisle to legislators who have expressed concerns about accountability and exasperation that the war is still raging after more than 19 months. President Joe Biden.
I hope my friends on the other side keep their word about support for Ukraine. They said they're going to support Ukraine in a separate vote. We cannot, under any circumstance, allow American support for Ukraine to be interrupted. I fully expect the Speaker to keep his commitment to secure the passage and support needed to help Ukraine as they defend themselves against aggression and brutality.
On Monday, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre told VOA that the administration remains determined amid this domestic pressure and concerns from the newly elected leader of NATO member Slovakia, who campaigned that he would not send a single bullet to Ukraine from the state stocks. Jean-Pierre.
NATO alliance, it's the strongest that it's ever been because of what this president's leadership has been. We're going to continue to certainly have those conversations with our partners and allies. But look, and I said this earlier, it does not help. It does not help what we see House Republicans doing.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, hosting European foreign ministers in Kyiv on Monday, said unity is crucial.
Our victory explicitly depends on our cooperation. The more powerful and principled steps we take together, the sooner this war will end fairly, with the restoration of our territorial integrity and a reliable guarantee of peace for the whole of Europe.
And from Moscow, President Vladimir Putin's spokesman appeared to take a dig at the situation, saying Moscow sees tiredness among Western supporters. To which Jean-Pierre replied,
and if Putin thinks he can outlast us, he's wrong. He's wrong. And so we will have another package of aid for Ukraine soon to signal our continued support for the brave people of Ukraine. And so that's our message. If he thinks he can outlast us, that is Mr. Putin, we believe he's wrong.
But military experts acknowledge that Zelensky's counteroffensive, which aimed to bite off chunks of Russian-held territory, has been slower than hoped. Mark Kansian is a retired U.S. Marine colonel, now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The results have been disappointing. And a number of people are asking the question, how does this end? What is Ukraine's theory of victory? I think President Zelensky is going to have to articulate that in the next couple of months in order to rally his supporters.
But the Ukrainian people remain determined. Over the weekend, the besieged capital held its first full marathon since the start of the invasion. 5,000 participants, many of them service members, some of them amputees, ran the 42-kilometer course to raise money for the nation's defense, step by painful step. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
An American and a Hungarian scientist who jointly worked on the groundbreaking technology behind some of the most effective COVID vaccine have been awarded the 2023 Nobel Prize for Medicine, one of the most prestigious awards in the field. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
mRNA technology was crucial in developing the Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccines. Hungarian-American scientist Katalin Karikó and her American colleague Drew Weissman began working on mRNA technology in the early 1990s at the University of Pennsylvania. The Nobel Prize Committee in Sweden said the discovery had helped defeat one of the greatest threats to human health in modern times. Rickard Sandberg is a member of the Nobel Prize in Medicine Committee.
mRNA vaccines, together with other COVID-19 vaccines, have been administered over 13 billion times. Together, they have saved millions of lives, prevented severe COVID-19, reduced the overall disease burden, and enabled societies to open up again.
mRNA, or messenger RNA, instructs cells to make proteins that match those found on the surface of pathogens, like the coronavirus. The body sees these as invaders and makes antibodies and T cells to attack them, thus training it to deal with a real virus in the future. In 2005, Karikó and Weissman worked out a way to stop the immune system from attacking RNA made in the laboratory, previously seen as a major hurdle against its use. Karikó said Monday they made a good team.
I was the RNA person and Drew was an immunologist, and we educated each other. And together, you know, we learned each other and developed mRNA.
Weissman said the future potential for mRNA was incredible.
We've been thinking for years about everything that we could do with RNA, and now it's here.
The coronavirus pandemic accelerated the development of mRNA technology, says scientist Paul Hunter.
Prior to COVID, you know, people knew that work was being done on mRNA vaccines, but I don't think we were ever close to getting real-world use of the technology. Now that it's been shown to work probably better than many, if not most, other vaccine types, I think is a big boost to it. And it's, there are a substantial number of potential uses of this technology.
It's hoped mRNA technology could one day be used to fight cancer. Gunilla Carlsson-Hedestam is chair of the Nobel Committee for Medicine.
Vaccines that are targeted towards specific kinds of tumors, maybe even to specific individuals, or personalized cancers.
Karikó and Weissman share the prize of $1 million and will receive their medals at a ceremony in Stockholm later this year. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
That's all we prepared for you this Tuesday, October 3rd, 2023. We now leave you with Ahmed Bremer and the song Juba Alish. Listening to Ahmed Bremer and the song Jubal Ish. I'm your host John Tanza on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer Kwame Ofori and engineer Cornelius, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
وشتل وشتل شتل المنام وجونا عظيم.